Welcome to Native America Calling. From Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. A data project found the Mountain States region has the highest per capita fatal encounters with the police. Today, we'll talk with a reporter who worked on the project. Also, Acoma Pueblo has filed an injunction against the Indian Health Service to prevent the closure of their hospital. We'll hear from the Pueblo's governor. And President Trump issued a pardon to a Lakota woman serving 30 years in prison for dealing meth. We'll talk with her about what's next. Those stories and more right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Indigenous Services Minister is warning people against schemes to get COVID-19 vaccines after a wealthy British Columbia couple flew to the Yukon for vaccinations intended for a First Nation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the incident has caused outrage as government and Native leaders speak out.
Rod and Ekaterina Baker each face fines of $1,150 for allegedly failing to self-isolate and failing to behave in a manner consistent with the declarations made on their arrival in Yukon. The multimillionaire couple chartered a plane to Beaver Creek, Yukon, the home of the White River First Nation. They claimed to be local workers in order to obtain vaccinations. Remote communities such as Beaver Creek are prioritized for early vaccinations. Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller says there is a scarcity of doses and this shouldn't have happened.
That was the most idiotic thing I've seen in weeks. I understand these people are wealthy and I won't tell them what to do with their money, but perhaps reparations are due of some level.
Most people who enter Yukon for non-essential reasons must also provide a 14-day isolation plan. Officials say the couple did not follow the territory's isolation rules. Dr. Bonnie Henry is the health officer for British Columbia.
I think they should be ashamed of themselves. They put a community at risk for their own benefit, and that to me is appalling.
Many people in the community and across the Yukon are angry over the incident. The Assembly of First Nations says Rod Baker owes a moral debt to the First Nation. Baker has since resigned as the CEO of casino operator Great Canadian Gaming. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Researchers have confirmed the location of an important site in Tlingit history in Southeast Alaska's Sitka National Historical Park. KCAW's Aaron McKinstry has more.
A peaceful clearing, a plaque, and a totem pole mark the spot where Shishkinu, or the Fort of Young Saplings, once stood.
It's a sacred place, and I have been going out there for years when I feel in the need of strength.
Louise Brady is Kiksetti from the Point House in Sitka.
I go out there because that's where my ancestors died, for this land and for us.
The fort was built following the Battle of Old Sitka in 1802, when the Kiksetti ousted Russian colonists from a site around 7 miles north. They anticipated the Russian return 2 years later and held off invaders from the fort for 4 days, until the loss of their gunpowder supply ultimately forced them to retreat and abandon the site. Oral histories and archaeological evidence pointed to the clearing near the mouth of the Indian River, but some thought the fort stood in a different part of the park. A study released this week in the journal Antiquity has dispelled those doubts. Tommy Urban is a research scientist at Cornell University and the study's co-author.
We did such a large survey, you know, much larger than the area immediately around the fort clearing, you know, because we wanted to rule out these other possibilities that it could be located somewhere else in the park.
Urban used something called an electromagnetic induction unit, which works kind of like a metal detector, to survey more than 40 acres of park property by hand over the course of 2 weeks. He also used a tool called a ground-penetrating radar. The technologies helped Urban and co-author Brennan Carter determine the exact outline of the wooden fort, which was slightly larger than the current clearing and shaped like a trapezoid. Brady of the Kiksetti clan says it's reassuring to know with certainty where the fort once stood.
Now we know for sure that this is the place that this happened, and let's learn more, and let's learn more together.
Brady says she's always pleased when scientific and technological findings align with oral histories. I'm Erin McKinstry.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme. Support by Navajo Language Renaissance, presenting Rosetta Stone Navajo for iPads, iPhones, Chromebooks, and Android devices with two learning levels and a self-correcting pronunciation feature. Info at NavajoRenaissance.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. It's our regular news roundup today. Right now, the governor of Acoma is holding a press conference to announce that they're filing a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for closing the Acoma Canyoncito Laguna Hospital and turning the service unit into an urgent care center open only during business hours. We'll talk with Governor Vio later in the show and find out more. Also, we'll talk with journalist Savannah Maher about an investigation into fatal police shootings. And we'll hear from LaVon Roach. She was recently released from prison after a pardon from President Trump. But first, let's head to Alaska to celebrate a momentous award. Tlingit illustrator Michaela Goad just won the Caldecott Medal for the book We Are Water Protectors. It's the first time an Indigenous person has won the award, and the Native literary world is celebrating. On the line, we have Michaela Goad. Welcome to Native America Calling, Michaela.
Hi, Monica. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to talk with you. Michaela, how did it feel to get the news?
I was so shocked. I felt like a deer in the headlights. It was over a surprise Zoom, essentially like a surprise Zoom party. And that's when I got the news. And it's starting to sink in now. That was on Sunday. But it's just, yeah, it's so exciting. And I still can't quite believe it.
What do you think about the fact that this is the first time in the 83-year history of the Caldecotts that a Native person, and from what I understand, a woman of color, has won this award?
Yeah, when I first heard that, I was surprised, and then I suppose maybe not surprised at the same time. So, you know, it's an honor. I feel really deeply honored by the award. And I think it's really important to acknowledge the fact that this is the first time it's been awarded to an Indigenous artist, and reflect on that, celebrate it, and then just look to the future and really be excited about all the strides we're making in, you know, inclusivity and diversity within publishing, and just hope that our Indigenous children and adults can see themselves in this recognition. And, you know that their stories and their voices are incredibly powerful and much needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about the book for our listeners who may not know.
Sure. So the book is called We Are Water Protectors, written by my friend Carol Lindstrom, who is of the Turtle Mountain Ojibwe Band. And she wrote this story back in 2016. She was so inspired by the demonstrations, the stand at Standing Rock, and she really wanted to be there, and she couldn't be there at the time, so she wanted to write a story that could help. And originally she wanted a longer form, almost like a novel, but time is of the essence, and publishing is, long timelines. So she decided to do a picture book, and so it's rooted in Standing Rock, and it is inspired by the Standing Rock Water Protectors and the Indigenous-led movements for environmental justice around the world. And it sort of blends these real-life events with the more spiritual, a bit more cosmic, which was really fun from an illustration standpoint. And we were both just so blown away by the support that this book received. We thought it might be well received in certain communities, but we certainly didn't foresee it being so I just guess, yeah, embraced around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it shot up to the top of the list on Amazon. Where can folks find this book? Where can they, where would you like folks to, you know, go and check it out?
You know, I always love to support local bookshops if possible. I can't guarantee every local bookshop will be carrying it. But I also love to support Indigenous-owned bookstores like Red Planet Comics and Books or Birch Bark Books. And then bookshop.org is a great resource as well, since they work with local bookstores and try to give back.
All right. Michaela Goad, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on your big win.
Thank you, Ganesh.
And today is our regular news roundup. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got Savannah Marr on the line. She's the Indigenous Affairs reporter at KUNM and the Mountain West News Bureau. And Savannah is Mashpee Wampanoag. Hey there, Savannah. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us about the series that you worked on for the Mountain West News Bureau and your piece in it particular call, which was titled A Montana Family Speaks Out About Police Violence Against Indigenous People.
Sure. So basically this series started with a question. We wanted to know if it was true what we were hearing sort of anecdotally in the region, that it felt like there was a really high rate of police killings in the Mountain West. And so we brought on a data reporter, Jordan Worbs-Brock, who worked with us to sort of sift through the data that was available and see what we could find. And the first thing that we found is that the data is very messy and sort of incomplete. The federal government does track police killings, but not in a very consistent way. Police departments submit their own data voluntarily, and most of them don't participate. So we sort of gathered together information from a number of independent databases about police killings, and what we found was pretty alarming, that the Mountain West region does have the highest rate of police killings in the country. And as I explored in my contribution to the series, Native people are overrepresented in police killings in almost every state in the Mountain West.
And how overrepresented are they?
Well, for example, my story was set in Montana, where a place where we had been hearing anecdotally that there was a very high rate of police killings, particularly of Native people. And the data shows that in Montana, Native people are 60% are killed by the police. How can I phrase this? They make up about 6% of the population in Montana and 9% of the police killings that we know of. And in Montana, 10% of all police killings don't include data about the person's race. And as we know, often when somebody is marked in data as, you know, unspecified or something else or something like that, often we're talking about a Native person. So we think that figure is probably an undercount. So that's just one example.
And I know you're not the data reporter on this, but can you talk a little bit about, you know, the process of sifting through the data and being able to come up with numbers like this?
Sure. So our data reporter used some independent databases from the Washington Post, from some research collaboratives, one database called Fatal Encounters, one called Mapping Police Violence, and it's per capita data that we were using. And really it was our job as the reporters on this project to kind of flesh that data out and humanize it and attach some human stories to it. So that was in my story, I spoke to the family of Cole Stump, who was a man from the Rocky Boys Reservation in Montana who was killed by police in Billings in October. And so with Cole's case, basically there's very much that we still don't know. The Billings Police Department and the county attorney are still investigating it and haven't released a whole lot of information while it's under investigation. But basically what they have shared is that the police say that Mr. Stump had a gun on his person when he was killed and that he had pointed it at the police. And that's something that his family doesn't quite buy and would like to see some harder evidence for. But they're feeling frustrated that it doesn't feel like the community is asking those same hard questions of the Billings Police Department. And so that was part of what I explored, how sort of the culture of these border towns might lend itself to people not wanting to ask those hard questions when a Native person is killed by the police.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much attention to police killings this past year, of course. And I think it's really interesting that you sort of dug into this situation with Native folks. What did his family share with you about, you know, the frustration of not being able to get the answers that they wanted to get?
Right. And it is, they are feeling a lot of pain and a lot of frustration now, coming up on 4 months since Mr. Stump was killed, still not being able to get a lot of the information that they'd like from the police department. And I spoke with Cole's sister, Tashina Duran, who shared just kind of this feeling that it feels like a lot of people in the community just are not applying the same level of scrutiny and asking the same hard questions of the police department in Billings as we're seeing in bigger cities around the country and cities perhaps in less conservative states. And she did express a feeling that perhaps that's because her brother was a Native person and people in this community might be primed to accept the police narrative a little bit more readily when it's a Native person rather than asking those hard questions.
Yeah, and you see that a lot in border towns. We were talking about when we mean border towns, you know, on the edge of a reservation or being near a reservation. Savannah, hang tight. We want to talk more about this piece after the break. If you're just joining us, it's our regular news roundup today, and you can get in on the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. We're going to go to a short break, and we'll be right back. COVID infection rates are falling in many places across the country, but experts say the pandemic is far from over. Health officials are administering vaccines, but some people remain wary. Meanwhile, Native Nations are worried about the toll the disease is taking on their elders. We'll get the latest on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, and I'm joining you today through Skype. And it's our regular news roundup. If you've got a story that you want us to cover on our monthly news roundup show, you can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Also, if you want to weigh in on anything that we've been talking about so far, or we're planning on talking about, give us a call. Phone lines are open. We are live. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Savannah Marr is with us. She's the Indigenous Affairs reporter at KUNM and the Mountain West News Bureau. And before the break, we were talking about her piece, A Montana Family Speaks Out about Police Violence Against Indigenous People. Savannah, did you reach out to the Billings Police for this story?
Yeah, we did. And actually, we first spoke with Lieutenant Brandon Woolley of the Billings Police Department during a listening session that we held in the fall. For this series, we held community listening sessions as well as this listening session with law enforcement to hear what their feelings were on this issue. And so that's when we first talked to Lieutenant Woolley. And then he agreed to talk with me for this story about Indigenous people in particular. And basically what he expressed is he does not agree with a lot of the families of victims and activists in his community who feel that there is a racial bias in the way that the department operates. He doesn't think that that's happening in his department. He expressed that he feels that there needs to be, better social services, particularly in Indigenous communities for people that are struggling with substance abuse, mental health problems, homelessness, and things like that. And I spoke with a researcher in this story, Melanie Yazzie at the University of New Mexico, who studies border towns and policing in border towns. And she told me that she sees some problems with that framing of sort of casting the blame on Native communities, deflecting blame. And she saw a problem with sort of pinning the problem on historical trauma. She said that makes it more of an individual thing, like this individual person needs to deal with their trauma rather than addressing what is a systemic problem. Brandon Woolley also in our piece made a statement that I think was kind of alarming to some of my sources, that he doesn't agree with calls to redirect police funding away from police departments and into social services. He said he believes the Native community needs more policing and not less. And the piece included some reactions from local advocates and organizers who found that statement really alarming and upsetting.
Yeah, I know we've had a few discussions about this on our show as well, and it seems to come down to these sort of two lines that are taken, which are like, this is a social services problem versus this is a systemic institutionalized racism problem. And so far, I haven't seen, a lot of coming together of those two perspectives. And I also think about that, Savannah, when we talk about schools and failing schools, you kind of hear the exact same arguments, which is like the teachers saying, well, it's the parents' fault, and the parents saying it's the teacher's fault. And it's so complex to sort of unpack all of that as a journalist, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. And there often actually are points of agreement between those two camps. Like in this story, we saw folks on all sides of the issue pointing to the need for better social services in cities like Billings to care for people that are struggling. It was just sort of nobody quite agreed on what to do about that, as we see with Lieutenant Woolley's comment about what he sees as what would be a mistake to defund the police in border towns. He doesn't think that's the right approach, but he does agree that better social services are needed. So there are those points of agreement.
I really like this idea of these community listening sessions. Can you talk a little bit about that as an approach to creating a journalistic story like this?
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to make sure that we were engaging deeply with the communities we were reporting on for this series. And so we held these listening sessions on Zoom and had a lot of success and just sort of especially during the pandemic when, as reporters, we can't really get out there into the community and spend time with people the way that we usually do. I know that that's how I like to do my reporting. I like to be out in the community, and right now that's just not safe. So that's a strategy that we've been using and one that we'll continue to use. Actually, we're planning another listening session in the first week of February where I'll be talking with some folks in New Mexico about, with some Native folks in New Mexico about how online education has gone for them in the last year. And of course, there are also pitfalls to that kind of a strategy, because we know that one of the things that's made education really a struggle for a lot of Native people in this past year is that, you know, they don't have access to fast internet, or maybe don't have access to internet at all, or don't have enough devices in their home for everybody to be Zooming at the same time. So there are pitfalls, but it's just one way that we can reach people during this difficult time.
Yeah, you jumped to my next question, which is, what are you working on next, Savannah?
Right. Well, right now I'm working on a story about online Indigenous language learning during the pandemic, which has been a little bit more of an uplifting topic to dig into. Started working on it. I started working on it because I've actually been able to take classes in my own language in Wampanoag during this time. And I live in Albuquerque, very far away from my tribal homelands in Mashpee, Massachusetts. And that's just never been an option for me before, to learn my language from afar. And lately it has been. And so I kind of just wanted to see if other people were having that experience. And I found that a lot of people are. And I've spoken with some language teachers that are able to reach sort of far-flung students a lot better during the pandemic. And of course, you know, there's no such thing really as a silver lining during a pandemic after the year that we've just had, but it's, I guess, sort of a happy, maybe unintended consequence of a lot of language programs adapting and digitizing their learning resources.
And I think your language is a pretty extraordinary story too, of revival.
Yeah, absolutely. Our language was, we like to say, it was asleep, not dead, for more than 100 years. And it was revived by a woman named Jessie Little Doe Bear. She worked very hard throughout the 90s and the early 2000s to revive our language, using mostly a Bible, actually, that had been printed in Wampanoag, I believe in the 1600s. And yeah, now after a very long time of not having our language, people are learning again, and we, our children are learning. We have a Montessori school in Mashpee where it's an immersion school where very young children are learning to speak Wampanoag. So it is a pretty unique story.
Yeah, I love it, Savannah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And it is our monthly news roundup. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I have to say, there's a number of news stories that didn't make it into the show today, but I want to give a notice or shout out to, during the inauguration, there was this meme of Bernie Sanders with some mittens and Indian Country. You know, you really showed up with your meme game. I really appreciate it a lot. You can check out some reporting on it at Indian Country Today. Dalton Walker wrote a piece about this Bernie Sanders mitten memes. And if you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Now let's check in on another story from this month. On his last days in office, President Trump pardoned dozens of individuals, ranging from his political friends to nonviolent drug offenders in prison. And one of those pardons was a Lakota woman named LaVon Roach. She joins us today by phone. Welcome, LaVon.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you, LaVon, on the air. And so tell us how this pardon came about.
Well, I had been trying to, it's not actually a pardon, it's clemency. My sentence was commuted. But I had started about 8 or 9 years ago trying to, get some relief from the 30-year sentence that I had. And I did 23 of that before I got this clemency. But Amy Povall with Kendu Clemency was, in Extreme Help. She's the one that started it 8 years ago, fighting for me, trying to get me help. She got me an attorney with the CP14 project. I mean, she's just done so much for me, you know, and without her, I wouldn't have been where I am now, you know, and I just appreciate her and Malik doing work, you know, mm-hmm. with prisoners taking their own time. But she was very key in it.
And LaVon, let me ask you about, you know, we briefly mentioned it in the intro, but tell us about how what happened and how you came to end up serving a 30-year term in prison.
I received a 30-year term for a nonviolent drug offense. Conspiracy charges, which meant, and I had no idea, that if you take it to trial, they don't need no proof to convict you. All they can go by is hearsay. I was arrested with like a half a gram, $50 worth of meth, but I was methamphetamine, but I was charged with over $1 million worth, and I was working two jobs, you know, on subsidized housing. And you know, but the court system made me this big, big, major drug dealer, you know, and it wasn't true. But I mean,
LaVon, let me ask you this. You were using meth at the time, but it wasn't a situation where you were conspiring to sell, or were you selling meth?
Well, it started off with my... this guy I met, and I never used meth until he came in, you know, he was introduced into my life. He was Mario Osorio from San Salvador. And so he kind of got me started, and he didn't use no drugs at all. You know, he pretty much used me the whole time to introduce him to the people that he started eventually doing business with. You know, he came in and... you know, I introduced them to people, and that's how it started, you know.
So you got caught, and you ended, I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, a 30-year sentence is, I mean, sometimes we see people who haven't even, who've murdered people who haven't gotten 30 years. And so I'm wondering if it was explained to you why you got such a long sentence for this.
It was because of the testimony of one guy that said that he gave me over 84 kilos of methamphetamine, you know, and this is the same man that asked me to marry him before he testified and said he would buy me a house and take care of me and stuff. And I didn't even know him. I met him a couple times with my fiance, Mario Osorio. Who ended up allegedly committing suicide in prison with a gun, not in prison, in jail.
Mm. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
He died of an infection.
So what do you think about President Trump, LaVon? What do you think about President Trump giving you this clemency?
Well, I appreciate it, but I think he's still crazy.
Well, LaVon, what does it feel like to be out and to have, the rest of your life ahead of you?
It feels good. Right now I'm just trying to figure out how I'm going to help Can Do Clemency with Amy. And my goal and dream has always been to help the Native or other people. High-risk teens, maybe, you know, something like that. I'm not really sure how everything works out here nowadays, but I'm feeling my way around. But that's my dream, is to help children, you know, and hopefully, you know, I can help them make a different choice, because I was labeled, you know, and I want something better for, you know, all the kids. And I can't help all the kids, of course, but if I can make a difference in one of their lives, you know, I feel like it would be worth it. I mean, like right now, the prosecutor that prosecuted me in my federal trial is now this state prosecutor, and he is going to prosecute my daughter for some drug charges that she got. You know, it's scary for me.
Wow. LaVon, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. It's great to hear, and we wish you the best of luck in your future. We really appreciate it.
Okay, anytime. Thank you so much for allowing me to say what I have to say and bring attention to the injustices of the federal system.
Actually, before you go, LaVon, I just one more quick question I wanted to ask you. Can you tell us about the rates of Native people in prison?
Well, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, Native Americans are incarcerated at a rate of 38% higher than the national average of any other race. You know,
what do you think
about
that?
It's just mind-boggling. I'm part of that statistic there, you know. I just hope that, you know, justice could be done for our people, you know, and we can start living our life instead of living in oppression and being labeled and, you know, being treated fairly. That's what I mean, we are so underrepresented in society, but in prisons, we're overrepresented.
All right. LaVon, thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks to, we really appreciate, you know, having the opportunity to chat with you about this. We're going to go to a short break. And after the break, we're going to talk with the governor of the Pueblo of Acoma about a lawsuit that they just recently filed. If you want to get in on our conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. It's a regular news roundup. And also, if you've got a story you'd like us to cover, send us an email to comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com.
If you're a Native American entrepreneur looking to expand or start up a business, you should know about the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program, a federal program encouraging private lenders to make the business loan you need. The Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can support you. Information available by emailing dci@bia.gov. That's dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. It's our regular news roundup. And if you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. Number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to the phones real quick, take a quick call. Melvin in Santee, Nebraska, tuned in on KZYK. Hey there, Melvin.
Good morning. I would like to comment on the border town issues. You know, over the years, there's been many, many murders of Natives in these border towns. Plus, we have this missing and murdered Indigenous women issue. And it's really hard to work with these border towns in trying to deal with that issue. Plus, then you've got the local police shooting Native Americans in the community. And it's really been tough for many of the tribes to establish a good relationship with any of these border towns.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we want to do is try to get these independent investigations into these border town killings, because there's a lot of them, you know? And we need a lot of help in dealing with these issues of police killing Indians and the missing and murdered women.
Absolutely, Melvin. Thank you so much for joining us, giving us a call. We appreciate it. And now let's talk with Brian Vio. He's the governor of the Pueblo of Acoma. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Governor Vio.
Good morning, Monica. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I wish it was under better news. But I understand that you have filed a lawsuit against the Health and Human Services, and IHS is under Health and Human Services. Tell us about this situation.
Yes, I too wish the circumstances were different. But as some of you know, the Pueblo of Acoma has been challenged with a situation created by the Indian Health Service that has called for the closure of our hospital here located on the Acoma Reservation. And while we have had the opportunity to have some discussions with the Albuquerque Area Indian Health Service, as well as headquarters under the direction of Rear Admiral Michael Wiyaki, the consistent messaging of the Indian Health Service has been that they are not willing to make a commitment to ensure that the ACL hospital would continue to operate at full capacity. Rather, they have continuously stated the need and their desire to close the hospital and to reduce it to a clinic with limited hours, no emergency care services, discontinuance of other critical services, healthcare services. And this has just not been acceptable to the Pueblo of Acoma. And so the Tribal Council did call Dr. Leonard Thomas to a meeting on Friday of last week, where he basically reiterated the same messaging, and absolutely no commitment was given to the Pueblo. So as a result of that, we have had no other choice but to file an order in the federal district court for the District of Columbia against the Department of Health and Human Services, and specifically identifying the Indian Health Service for reinstatement of full operations of the ACL hospital.
And I reached out to IHS and invited them to be on the show today. They did send a statement which said the Indian Health Service remains committed to providing comprehensive quality health care to patients at the Acoma Cañoncito Laguna Service Unit. The Acoma Cañoncito Laguna Service Unit remains open to provide health care to patients. However, it does not currently have sufficient staffing to provide some services. The upcoming tribal assumption resulted in a reduction in force at the facility, and many employees have already transferred, retired, or otherwise left the agency. And so, and I'll put the full statement that they gave us on our website at NativeAmericaCalling.com. So, Governor Vio, what are you seeing as the consequences of a reduction in service, if any, that are happening because of this, particularly when we think about this happening during a pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. And that has been our main, one of our main arguments is that, you know, under a public health would not condone the practice of public health, just it would not condone and see on any level of, you know, ethics that this action of the IHS is ethical, and it is unfortunate that the Indian Health Service, even while the federal government and Congress, who have established a policy for the Department of Health and Human Services to provide 1 year's advance notice to the Congress of their intent to close a hospital and to conduct a divisibility study to substantiate that action, that the Indian Health Service continues to claim that they have discretionary right to make these decisions and that they can do it without any consultation with the Pueblo. Now, we would agree that there is maybe an unsafe situation currently because of the lack of staffing. But that lack of staffing is a direct result of their lack of consultation, one, but also lack of carefully administering their own process to avoid the situation of not having staff available to administer these medical services. So they've created that unsafe situation The Pueblo of Acoma had absolutely no involvement in that, though the Pueblo of Acoma has certainly stepped forward to assist in identifying any potential medical providers that could come to the ACL hospital. Unfortunately, because of the global pandemic and the situation here in the United States, those medical providers are far and few. And so, but you know, it is the responsibility of the Indian Health Services to locate and hire and bring those medical providers to this hospital to ensure that those services that they say they are committed to providing are in fact provided to the tribes who are serviced by this hospital, and that includes the Pueblo of Acoma, the Pueblo of Laguna, and the Tohajali Band of Navajo.
So for our listeners who may not understand Governor Vallo, if there is an emergency medical situation on the Pueblo of Acoma, let's say on a Saturday afternoon, where can folks go?
Well, this is the crisis. This is the real crisis here, and we've already had loss of life as a result of this action by the Indian Health Service. That if someone falls ill or has an emergency, a medical emergency, after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, between 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 o'clock the next morning, they have to drive themselves or call EMS to transport them to Albuquerque. Grants, the city of Grants, which is located about 20 minutes from Acoma, is operating at full capacity. So they are not an option, even while the Indian Health Service has identified them as an option for emergency care. But what our tribal members are left with is the only option is to drive themselves or have or be driven via EMS to a hospital in Albuquerque, which we also know some being at full capacity. And so, you know, that is just, it is unacceptable. It's just unconscionable that's what personnel at ACL Hospital are communicating to our tribal members, is basically go find the help you need.
Yeah.
We can't do anything for you. And even those tribal members who have gone to the ACL hospital during those hours of closure, they are told, well, you can call EMS and you're welcome to stay in the parking lot until they come pick you up.
Wow. Well, Governor Vallo, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We will keep an eye on this story as it unfolds. IHS responds to this injunction. Finally, today, we want to take a moment to remember Laura Waterman Whitstock. She walked on this month at the age of 83. She was the founder of Migazee, a media organization in Minneapolis, and host of First Person Radio. She was Seneca. Joining us now to talk about her life is Kelly Drummer. She's the president of Migazee, and she's Lakota Sioux. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Kelly.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be able to talk a little bit about Laura and her legacy, not only with Migazee, but the entire country and in our tribal communities and urban Indian communities. You know, her role in founding Migazee was really in radio, and we're fortunate enough to have all of the reel-to-reel tapes from the late 70s to the early 90s, and we will be digitizing those tapes and utilizing those in our current programming. And Laura was a mentor of mine, a friend. She was like one of my family members. So for not only me, but Migazee and our entire community, it's been a huge loss, but we know her legacy lives on in all of our work.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear that you have that archival record. I know particularly because Migazee had a fire this year, or fire last year, because of the unrest surrounding the death of George Floyd. Can you talk a little bit about Can you share a little bit about Laura and maybe a favorite story you have of her?
Sure. You know, this morning I was fortunate enough to present. The city of Minneapolis presented a resolution honoring Laura on September 11th as Laura Water and Woodstock Day, and that was that's her birthday. And I'll just read kind of what I wrote up for that resolution this morning, and it's kind of my story and how, and I think a lot of people in our community, their story and how they met Laura and, you know, what she did for young women, young men, and her leadership in the community. So I first met Laura 20 years ago at McGizzi's old building on 31st and Lake Street. I remember walking into the room and meeting her for the first time. I was nervous and scared to be in the room with leaders in the community that I had looked up to. I wasn't prepared to be in the presence of leaders that helped to change the world for us. That day, she asked me where I was from, where I went to school, and my family. I saw a spark in her eyes and a beautiful smile, and she told me that I belonged in that room. From that day forward, Laura mentored me, loved me, and my family. She was with us through our challenges and celebrations. She celebrated our marriage, the birth of two of our children, graduations, and was super proud of my attainment of my master's degree in philanthropy and development in 2008. For many years, we met every week, sometimes twice a week, so that she could help me navigate through the challenges and victories, both personally and professionally. I was able to sit with Laura a few days before she began her journey to the spirit world, and that spark in her eye from the first day we met was bright and shining. I am who I am today because of Laura, and I will always miss her.
Oh, that's beautiful, Kelly. Thank you so much. You know, I mentioned this before, but I know that McGizzi has really had a tough year. And I was wondering if you can give us any updates on, you know, how things are going with rebuilding and because of the fire that you had.
Well, today is just a very significant day kind of all the way around for McGizzi. We just signed a purchase agreement for a new building we will renovate at 1845 East Lake Street today. So we are the proud owners. I was on this call. I think I was on the show 4 or 5 months ago. And so happy to let everybody know that we are on the path to having a permanent home again. It will be sometime this fall, we hope. With COVID, it kind of may slow down a little bit on the renovations, but very proud owners of a new building and to really fulfill that legacy and dream, you know, Laura had for the organization and being around forever for our young people. So happy about that. It's a good day.
I love it. Thank you so much, Kelly. We really appreciate you sharing a little bit about Laura Waterman Woodstock. And if folks want to learn more about McGizzi, where can they go?
McGizzi.org, MIGIZI.ORG.
All right. I think we do have a link to that on our website as well. And so thanks so much, Kelly, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And we've reached the end of our hour. I want to say thank you so much to all of our guests, Michaela Goad, Savannah Marr, LaVon Roach, Governor Brian Vio, and Kelly Drummer. We're back next week with a whole nother 5 shows, different topics every single day. You know, you can sign up for our newsletter at NativeAmericaCalling.com, and every Friday, and only on Fridays, we'll send you an email with a list of upcoming shows that should be coming out in just a little bit, probably around 1 or 2 Mountain Time today. And our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Tara Gatewood. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is our engineer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director, and Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our resource development specialist. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief of operations. The president and CEO of Quantic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
Native America Calling is supported by Oregon State University eCampus. The strength that comes from your tribal community can make all the difference in reaching your goals. Oregon State eCampus is committed to providing another source of strength with a supportive educational community that respects your culture. Earn your degree online, but not on your own. Visit ecampus.oregonstate.edu/Native America Calling.
New to Sigur, so the saga of Sigi 2021 moon. Taptimuna, Ekayominasi, Natacharnik, Sle Nakuronik. Contact Louis Indian Healthcare Provider. Kasahangwasi Healthcare.gov, Nakakilalu 1-800-318-2596. Unakailuni Center for Medicare and Medicaid Servicemen.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.